Session number 12385, rule 4.
Pardon?
That's it. I was just saying which tape it is. Carry on.
So I'm just kind of, I cut down this garrulous, but I just wanted the effect of the people there, and then when the people like the sailors are resting about indolent and just waiting, nothing to do, and just sort of waiting for events to catch up with them. And then you see these ships are on the rest of the Russian fleet approaching, and the fellows looking through the periscope at the and then at once everything changes, everyone to battle stations and so on, and then they rush there, and then this was the first time I saw this film, and this was the first time that they'd they had when they ran up the red flag when they'd captured the ship, they'd had that hand painted in red. I'd seen many times, I think I've seen it about 50 times since then, and on many occasions that is missing from the print. It's just a black a flag, so that people who are not aware of the significance of the thing, they perhaps miss that. But anyway, that and then the ship goes out to meet the rest of the fleet, and the whole of the fleet, and then they run up the red flag, and again it's hand-painted, and they called the men signalling, the sailors signalling, do not shoot your proletarian brothers. And you see all the rest of the battleships gradually lower their guns, and the ship sails away to freedom in Romania. And after that was over, was just like that, and the lights came up, and I would say for a good 5 minutes there wasn't a sound to be heard, complete quietness, you know, and then everyone would start talking and so on. But
that was that first time.
That was the first time. Yes. That.
What did your friends think of the film? The men you went with.
Oh, they thought of it. They thought it was wonderful, of course, that, yes, I think they went, they were real communists, that they were, although von Mori came from his family, originally was sort of aristocrats or something, otherwise he wouldn't have had the von there, but he'd become a proletarian, and all the rest were proletarian seamen, so that it had an effect on them, and we talked about it afterwards. We thought how wonderful it was, but they didn't specifically talk about the art of the photography. It was just the theme of the thing, that the idea of other sailors, Navy people, refusing to fire on their brothers and so on. And that remained with me for all my life, and this time, right up to this day now. But it did resolve that I'm determined somehow I'm going to be a photographer. I don't know how. And that started the first faint beginnings of photography, and I never did amount to much of a photographer, but later on I can enlarge on that. And then we eventually landed up in Cairns, and I don't know whether Eric knew, but there was a skipper of a schooner the Y Manor. Again, I remember names that, he was thinking of starting out for the there for trading in the islands, and he hadn't got a crew, and I don't know whether Von Mori knew about him beforehand, or whether Waldemar Boer knew him, or something. That the skipper was a Finnish American, but he'd been quite a while in Australia, and he was a few years older than us. Also there was a little Australian. We're all foreigners, the whole lot, except for this little Australian. I think his name was Mitchell. Yes, and I think somehow you had to have, although it was registered in Australia, you had to have an officer that was Australian or something. I'm not conversant with that. But anyway, he was the chief officer. But we weren't so much officers and sailors. We were just a bunch of guys together, and he said, you won't be paid any wages or anything. You just get a from a share of the profits. And we agreed on that. There were never any profits much, but we spent a 1 year traveling around the islands. As far as Tahiti and all the other islands in the South Pacific, from one taking all sorts of goods and passengers from one island to another, which we enjoyed wonderfully well. And then after a year, this had so, I think by this time it was mostly about 1931. I think it must have been that's because we left the ship. We'd been in a hurricane, and it was a rather bad, suffered quite a bit of damage, although still seaworthy. We made it back to Cairns after one of the voyages, and but then the Japanese were attacking the Chinese in Shanghai, and Waldemar Boer and Eric and I talked it over and said, how we'd like to help the Chinese 8th Route Army. I think they were in Shanghai, you see. And then we said, well, we'll see if there are any ships going there. We tried to get one or two ships called in at Cairns. It might have been Townsville or Cairns, I'm not certain. We couldn't get... we couldn't be certain they were going to China, or certainly not to Shanghai. But then we did find a ship that was going to Shanghai, we took leave of the rest of the crew of the Y Manor, Mitchell, the big... the skipper, I've forgotten his name, Waldemar Boer, but Eric and I decided to stow away on the ship. It was going to Shanghai, so we stowed away on the ship, and when it was well out to sea, we came up on deck and so on. We got the general bad looks and so on, but they were set to work I don't think they paid us. I can't remember now. But anyway, when we got to Shanghai, we got off the ship. But I think we once came under the scrutiny of the... there was some sort of united force running Shanghai. They had what they called... I'd remember it later if... again, it's a sort of secluded zone just for foreigners. It was Americans and English, Italians, French, and so on.
International Zone, I think it was.
Pardon?
I think it was called the International Zone or something.
Yes, the International Zone. Quite illegally occupying that... and the Japanese also, and we could see vast clouds of smoke when we were arising from that. So they first of all said that, and we were put in the hands, because we'd come from Australia, of the, I think the British consul or something, and he said, well, you can't stay here, it's illegal, and this, that, and the other. We've got to get you a ship back to... Australia, but I think we put up on the sea. Anyway, he got us, provided us with tickets for the Seaman's Hostel in Shanghai, the British Seaman's Hospital, hostel, I mean. And then we set about trying to join the 8th Route Army, which... It was a bit difficult because we didn't speak Chinese and no one spoke English. And the 8th Route Army was retreating way to the north there. You saw plenty of Japanese around the city, but apparently the fighting had all finished in the city itself. And you just had these billows of smoke and sort of rising so that... it was something that, we've had a wasted journey. If we could possibly have made it somehow, that if we knew someone or Chinese who could speak English or and was a communist and could lead us to the 8th Route Army, we would have been there. But it just, what are you going to do when you're in a war-torn city, everything razed and you can't speak... I suppose we should have thought about this before we started out. Anyway, they found us a ship going back to Australia.
But before you say that, how long were you in Shanghai for?
Oh, 3 weeks.
What did you do while you were there?
Pardon?
What did you do while you were there?
Well, we just wandered around the... a city in the International Settlement. I think they call it the International Settlement, I've got a feeling. What we did notice with... I've never actually seen that. At the park gates in the International Settlement, it had a big notice that no dogs or Chinese admitted in... all languages, in English, in French, in, don't think German, Italian, and whatever that, I don't think the Germans had any say in it because they were defeated in the last war. But anyway, whatever it is, three or four languages, no Chinese or dogs admitted in this park. And that struck us, that here you are in a Chinese city and the Chinese are not allowed in their park. So that, anyway, we got on this.
Can I ask you?
Yes, sure.
What other impressions did you get of Shanghai at that time?
Well.
How were the Chinese?
The Chinese, you couldn't communicate with them. Some spoke English, of course, being an international city. We tried to speak to them, but they were sort of wary about speaking to you. We spoke to a few of them, but we saw other people living on boats in the river there that sort of whole families were living there in terrible poverty and in the other part of course the great part of Shanghai that where the majority of Chinese lived was just a smoking ruin at that time. But the part around the Bund wasn't harmed at all there. The people there, it was only just out from the international part where, as I recollect it, the boat people lived further up the river. That's where you got some of these houses. I gathered that the Chinese that... we saw walking around, they were sort of wealthier Chinese, and I never was able to get their reaction from, and I suppose they were wary about talking to foreigners anyway, so that we just saw a great deal of poverty and degradation and so on, something that we'd already knew about before we went there.
What other signs of the fighting did you see?
Pardon?
What other signs of the fighting did you see? Apart from, you said you saw some smoke.
Yes.
What other signs of the fighting did you see?
No other signs, because you had the Japanese. You couldn't go there. There were lots of Japanese soldiers parading. You couldn't get too close to where all this, you only saw it from the distance of, I suppose, about half a mile or so away, that if you tried to get any closer to that, you'd see these Japanese, I think they were Marines, they were dressed rather like American Marines with leggings on, and I think... Or they may have been Navy people, but all carrying guns and so on. We thought, we wouldn't press our luck too much about going too close. So we just watched and saw that, and we just saw it was hopeless to try and make our way there, but... there were probably people in Shanghai that could have helped us if we'd only known that. We got this job on a British ship going back to Australia, and again in Cairns or Townsville, we paid off. We got the job now. We got paid for our journey there. And then at this time, Von Mori said that I have a feeling that things are just getting so bad back home that I feel I have a duty to return to Germany and help with the struggle against there's this... crazy person Hitler there that he seems to be beating up and killing communists and socialists and everywhere else. I think this must have been well before the Reichstag was burned and so on, but there was enough, I think it was about 1931 then, there was this feeling that they were struggling to take power. The Weimar Republic was still there, and I think the general, I've forgotten his, the president of
Bismarck.
Pardon?
Bismarck. I can't remember.
No, that,
it's not Bismarck,
sorry. Yes, anyway, that one that was became more or less a figurehead, yeah. That and the socialists wouldn't agree with the communists. I realise now that the communists could have been halfway to blame, but the socialists were greater, because the last election that Hitler held, the communists and socialists outnumbered him by a large majority. But
don't digress. What did he say he wanted to do? He said he wanted to go back to Germany, your friend.
Pardon?
Can you explain about him saying he was wanting to go back to Germany?
He wanted to go back?
Yeah.
Yes, because he felt that this is becoming an increasing threat, that the Nazis are going to revolt somehow, gain control of the affair. And anyway, they're slaughtering socialists and communists in the street, and my place is beside them to struggle against Nazism. He was a confirmed communist and one of the most wonderful people that I've ever known. Also very widely read. He'd read all of Marx, a great deal of Marx and Engels, and also a great deal of the books that I'd also read in the past. And there was, I don't like to talk about love between men, but in a way there was a great attachment between Erich von Mori and myself. And so when he said that I feel my place is beside my comrades in Hamburg or Bremen, I sort of half agreed. So I said, oh, okay, well, but I still had this hankering for getting on a windjammer, a square rigger, you see. But anyway, when we were in there, they a German ship called in. It was a huge lumbering freighter at the time when most freighters were only about, many were 4,000 tons or 8,000 or 10,000 was a large freighter at that time. This one was, I think, a freighter that had, because Germany had lost a great deal of her shipping in the First World War, and this was only, relatively less than 15 years after the war. And there was this lumbering freighter there. I know it had two funnels. I've got a feeling it was called the Bremerhaven. I'm not certain. Distinct from the Bremen, which and this was converted into a freighter because they were short of shipping. Actually, von Mori, although he'd been on deck several times, he was a fireman on ships, so Eric said we went on board, and again they were short-handed. I think, not surprisingly, some of the crew had beaten it in Australia, and so we. But there was no deck jobs. All there was a job is firing in this ship that I had no experience of firing, but Eric says, he's been a fireman and this, that, and the other. And, of course, he had, so he knew all the answers. And then, we got down there, and it's the nearest Dante's Inferno that I've ever lived through. We were in the tropics. There were no air conditioning at that time. It was sort of coal, and all you had were these steel plates. You were stripped to the waist, just underpants on and shoes because of the coal from the fire coming out. And then we had a job as firemen, because firemen get paid more than what they call coal passers. I think the British go on, they call them stokers, but we were firemen, and these coal passers would get the coal from the bunkers and wheel it up to the furnace doors, and then it was a question of for 4 solid hours you'd be shoveling coal into the mouths of this vast, I forget how many boilers that she had, and you'd be shoveling coal in, raking and then slicing, shoveling, raking and slicing, and the sweat was pouring out, all the coal dust and the sweat, and you just had sweat rags round your throat, which you kept wiping your face with, and all the coal dust was matted in your hair and pouring down. You were just black from completely from head to foot, and the coal dust. And they had these cowlings. I don't know whether you've seen them on old steamships, which they turned towards the wind to catch the wind. But only wind that you had in the tropics of northern Australia was hot wind anyway, that and it didn't amount to... and then we sweated there. So, and that first 4 hours, of course, Eric was used to it and I wasn't, but we'd all lived a tough life, and we'd been on this... ship in the South Seas and come through, of course, a terrible hurricane and so on there, that I forgot to mention that, but anyway, that we were hard work, so it wouldn't be like someone else, but this was something that it was hard to believe, and it is beyond the realms of imagination for people, of sailors, going to sea at this time, to that condition. And this ship, above all, was such a lumbering ship of 20,000 tons that you've got to keep going and fueling through the tropics, so that then we got down to Brisbane. And then when you got to Brisbane, you're loading up with coal again, the bunkers with loading with coal, and you've got to see that that's loaded correctly, so it doesn't tell. Well, we didn't, but you had to help with that. And then again, and so we went down to Sydney. We called in at Sydney, and then Port Adelaide and Melbourne, I think, dropping goods off. You weren't allowed to trade foreigners between one port and another, but they were allowed to drop off the goods that they'd brought. I don't know where she'd come from. Possibly Japan, this German ship. And then going across the Great Australian Bight, we ran into a terrific storm there, and although the marginally cooler, because we were out of the tropics by this time, that the fact that you've got to keep these fire furnaces going full on, and these officers, Eric said they're all Nazis, these officers on the ship. They didn't beat you like the old oarsmen on the Roman galleys, but they'd beat you with their tongues if you couldn't keep up the steam and so on. And when you got this horrific storm and the steel deck was coming up to meet you, and you still had to shovel the coal in and so on, was something terrific. And if the level of the steam was dropping, the chief engineer would come into the into the where you are keeping the, and really lash the people with his tongue and so on, and saying that money would be deducted and this sort of thing, that so that eventually, anyway, we made it through the storm there, and then we got to Albany in Western Australia, and I think I stuck it out just to show that I wasn't a quitter, you know, that at last I lasted through all the tropics, and I don't know how long it took us there, but several weeks there, that but then I thought, well, you know, Eric feels he's got to go back to Australia, so he's stopping on the ship. And I said, well, I've still got a feeling I'd like to try for one of these windjammers. So he said, oh, well, you know, good luck to you. Well, maybe if you get it to London, you can write from London to, he gave me his address in Bremen, and we'll meet up when we get to Europe. So then I took the wages I had coming to me. They agreed to sign me off in Albany, and I got a...